Hi, this is Roy Shoman. Welcome again to Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism, the show on Radio Maria that celebrates the Jewish roots of the Catholic faith, or seen the other way around, that celebrates the completion, the fulfillment, the full realization of Judaism in the Catholic Church and its sacraments. If you were with us a few weeks ago, you might have heard a very beautiful witness testimony that I had a guest on, a young Muslim woman who gave her story of how she became a believer in Christ, and a very on fire and apostolic believer. She had brought many other Muslims that she had come in contact with into relationship with Jesus. And I had the very good fortune of finally meeting to my mind, the most prominent Christian evangelist to Muslims, probably the only other one that I know, David Wood, who has a very active ministry and has a number of very beautiful videos on YouTube. You might want to subscribe to his channel even. His name is, of course, David Wood, spelled just like one would think. And anyway, I had the opportunity to meet him and to invite him on the show to talk about among other things, evangelizing Muslims, the problems and the approaches that can be used, the need to, and I think that's something that we all should be more aware of, is that as Christians and having a relationship, one hopes, a true relationship with Jesus Christ, we have been given the greatest gift that God ever gave to mankind through no virtue or anything that we deserve. And having been given such a great gift, the least we can do is try to share it with our less fortunate brethren. And I would dare to say that among the least fortunate of our less fortunate brethren would be the Muslims, who not only don't have Jesus, but have a characterization of the relationship between God and man, which may seem rather oppressive when you have to live under it. So with that rather rambling introduction, let me invite you, David, to speak your piece. So welcome to the show, David.
Welcome. Thanks. Yeah, this is actually, it's easy to get discouraged when we see a lot of the things going on around the world with, Boko Haram in Nigeria and Al-Shabaab in Somalia and ISIS and the Taliban and persecution of Christians worldwide. I think the recent statistic was something like 80% of religious-based persecution in the world is now directed towards Christians. And so it's easy to get discouraged at a lot of what's going on in the world. But at the same time, we have a lot to be excited about. And if someone is interested in reaching Muslims with the gospel, no generation has ever had the kind of opportunities that we have right now to reach Muslims with the gospel. For pretty much 14 centuries, civilizations were not completely segregated, but you basically had the Muslim East and the Christian West. And if you had a heart for Muslims and you wanted to reach Muslims with the gospel and you decided to, you know, go preach the gospel to Muslims, if you were successful enough to raise any eyebrows, you had a good chance of getting your head chopped off. And there were lots of Christian martyrs over the centuries who were killed for wanting to bring the gospel to Muslims. So for 14 centuries, that has been like that. And Muslim leaders have been able to keep their people basically insulated from hearing any criticisms against Islam and any serious presentation of an alternative to Islam. And so that's how it's been. It's been very dangerous to challenge that. And all of a sudden, just within our lifetimes, we can suddenly talk to Muslims in Mecca on Facebook if we want. We can talk to Muslims in Pakistan and anywhere in the Muslim world, anywhere there are Muslims with internet access right now, we can talk to them. And so Muslims who for so many centuries would have been shielded from hearing any of this, all of a sudden now have open access to challenges to Islam and to presentations of the gospel. And even apart from that, we have, of course, much more integration now, where we have Muslims moving to the West, either to go to college or to move here permanently. And so, I mean, you know, I live in the Bronx. I can't walk outside without seeing Muslims. There are Muslims all over New York now. And so, yeah, there are things to be discouraged about with, you know, the violence and the persecution in the world, and PC culture and things like that. But if someone really, really wants to present Muslims with the gospel, it's not even close. We are living in the best time in history right now.
So what are some of the avenues that you use to kind of get a wedge into opening their mind to the possibility that, Jesus is who we know he was, is?
Well, what you find is Muslims tend to have a very high respect for authority, the authority of their leaders. They really trust what their imam has told them. They trust what their parents have told them. And as they're growing up, they don't get a lot of challenges to that. And so, normally if I'm starting off a conversation with a Muslim, and it'll depend on the situation. If I'm talking to a Muslim one-on-one, that's one situation. If I'm having a public debate, it's sort of a different sort of situation. If I'm making a video, that's a different kind of situation. But, if I'm just having a conversation with a Muslim, I'll usually just start by asking the Muslim questions about what he believes or what she believes, because, you know, you have to find these things out. There are differences, among Muslims. And so, you know, what do you believe about Jesus? What do you believe about the Quran? What do you believe about Muhammad? What do you believe about the Bible? And, you know, they'll start giving answers, and eventually, start asking more along the lines of, why do you believe that? Right? So here's what I believe about the Quran. I believe that the Quran is the perfectly preserved word of Allah that was revealed to Muhammad by Gabriel and so on. And then ask, why do you believe that? And the answers, the kinds of answers that you'll get if they said something about the Quran will be something along the lines of, because, you know, it's the only book that's been perfectly preserved right down to the letter from the time it was revealed to Muhammad. And it's important to follow those kinds of responses up with questions, namely something like, what sort of investigation did you do to conclude that the Quran, not a single letter has ever been changed? Because according to their sources and according to the manuscript tradition, that claim is completely false. The Muslim sources talk about entire chapters of the Quran coming up missing, large passages coming up missing. Aisha had the only copy of certain verses and they were eaten by a sheep. And so those verses that which they talk about in the Muslim sources that are supposedly in the Quran aren't in the Quran anymore. You go to the sources, why aren't they there anymore? Because Aisha's sheep ate the only copy. That's the sort of thing you read about in the Muslim sources, and it's totally the opposite of what Muslims are told by their leaders today. And so when a Muslim says, I believe in the Quran because it's been perfectly preserved, we know that it's not based on any actual investigation. They just heard it and they believed it. And so one of the first steps is getting them to realize that and saying, not even challenging them at this point, just asking for reason. So at first you're asking for information about what they believe. And then the next step would be asking for their reasons for what they believe. And you're hoping that they realize, after just a few questions, that they're just believing what their leaders told them to believe. And somewhere along the lines, once it's, well, you know, my imam is so intelligent and he's done lots of studying and he says, somewhere along the lines, it's good to get in a question along the lines of, if your imam were wrong about this, if he had told you something wrong, if he had said something false, would you want to know it? Would you want to know that what he said was false? Or would you want to go on believing it anyway, even if what he said was false? And hopefully a person who believes in God and believes in, you know, knowing the truth about God will say, yes, I would want to know it. And then, at that point, might say, oh, could we meet again so that we can discuss whether, you know, that view of the Quran, or this could be any topic, I'm just using the Quran as an example here. Could we meet again where we actually look into whether that claim is correct? And there are lots of Muslims who will say yes. And then, you know, you sit down and you start going through their sources about what they say, and you're looking for kind of a light switch moment where at first, you know, If it says right here, two chapters came up missing because Muslims kept forgetting to recite them. Isn't that different from perfect preservation right down to the letter? And well, maybe this is abrogated, or maybe this is...
What are the sources?
That's Sahih Muslim. That's one of their two most respected collections of hadith. Yeah. sources like Bukhari, their other favorite collection, talks about Uthman burning all of the Qurans because there were so many differences among the manuscripts of the Quran. You don't get anything like a picture of perfect preservation when you read the Muslim sources. In fact, in Sahih al-Bukhari, Muhammad told his followers, if you want to learn the Quran from anyone, learn it from these four people, and he gave four names. We know two of the people on that list, two of those four names, did not agree with the Quran that we have now. They didn't even agree on the number of chapters. So the Quran we have today is 114 chapters. Abdullah ibn Mas'ud was Muhammad's top reciter of the Quran. He's the number one guy. Muhammad said, if you want to learn the Quran from anyone, learn it from him. He only had 111 chapters in his Quran. He didn't believe that Surah 1, Surah 113, or Surah 114 are supposed to be in the Quran. He thought these were just early Muslim prayers, not Quran. Ubay ibn Ka'b was another guy on the list. He had all of the chapters that are in there now, plus two more chapters that aren't included in this Quran. So your average Muslim knows none of this. And I've even talked to Muslim apologists who are telling Muslims how to refute Christianity by showing the perfect preservation of the Quran and so on. And I was with my friend Nabil, who was a former Muslim, and we walked up to him afterwards, and Nabil said, well, what do you do with people like Ubay ibn Ka'b or Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, who didn't even agree with the chapters? And the Muslim apologist said, well, I'm sorry, I've never heard of these names before. And these are guys who are all over their top sources. And so you even have Muslim apologists who are going out there defending Islam who have no clue what's in their most common sources, because it's not emphasized by the actual scholars, because the scholars know as soon as people start reading this material, they're going to find out how it conflicts with their beliefs. And so, you know, hopefully you get that across. And again, it's like a light switch moment when at first they're going to defend it. At first they're going to try and justify it. They might get angry, but eventually it's like a light switch turns on and they realize, if my leaders were not telling me the truth about that, what else are they not telling me about? And maybe instead of just trusting them, I have to look into this for myself and start going through some of this material. And once they do that, then the door is open for now you've got a presentation of the gospel. Now they can think their way through it and so on. I've seen lots of Muslims who have left Islam, and with their families, if they're in the West, there are usually two reactions. And one of them, of course, is, you know, this was the last time I saw my family. My family told me don't talk to us anymore until you return to Islam. But, a little more common than that is they try to win them back, and they think if they just take them around to, various Muslim scholars, that these Muslim scholars will get them back on the right track. And, that's actually pretty important, because it shows that, you know, the family, the parents really have confidence, the same confidence that they were encouraging in their children. Namely, that if we can't answer something, our leaders have the answers. But these young people who had left Islam would then go to the leaders and ask the same questions and find out the leaders can't answer this either. That's a fact. You can go to a Muslim, a brilliant Muslim scholar, the most brilliant Muslim scholar in the world. How do you maintain perfect preservation when all of our sources say the Quran has not been perfectly preserved? And there's no good answer.
So I would imagine the same question has been turned back at you when the person that you're evangelizing turns to you and says, well, the only reason you believe in Christianity is because somebody with authority told you. And I know from listening to your witness testimony that you have better answers than that to why you believe, that you are prepared to say that the belief in Christianity has a basis other than argument from authority. Mm-hmm. What's that?
I grew up as an atheist when I was pretty young. It just wasn't emphasized by anyone around me. Eventually, if I stayed over at my grandmother's house for some reason, she would take me to church, but that was really my only exposure to Christianity. And all I did was go and sit in the church and stare at the clock until they said we could go get brownies. And that was my early exposure to Christianity. But I became a Christian because I examined the evidence for the resurrection in response to a Christian who had challenged me and made me angry enough when I was 19 years old to start examining it. And
So you were, let me just get this straight. So you were a convinced atheist who started studying Christianity in order to win the argument with a Christian who was trying to defend the truth of Christianity.
Yeah, I don't remember ever believing in God when I was young, but I didn't think about it much until, but I was maybe 13 years old when I did think through it, and that's when I identified as an atheist. And I probably started telling people when I was maybe 15 or so. That's when I started telling other people that I'm an atheist. And, so 19, this Christian actually got into arguments with me. Before that, if I get into an argument with a Christian, they would always back down. But, this Christian didn't, and he annoyed me enough to where I wanted to go, look into this to prove him wrong. And, 20 years old, I, became convinced that Jesus rose from the dead. And so I became a Christian, but, you know, the idea that, you know, we just believe certain things because people in authority, told us these things, there's nothing inherently wrong about believing something that someone tells you. I mean, most of what we learn, we were told by other people. Yeah. I know my ABCs because someone told me my ABCs. So that in itself is not bad, but when it's to the point where you don't get to question what's being told, even if there's evidence to the contrary, that's when it becomes a problem. And when you have people who are in authority, who are saying things that are demonstrably false, or that you can present a good case against, then it's not a good idea to just simply go on believing them no matter what they say. And so if you're a Muslim and you've been told all your life your leaders have the answer, then as far as you know, it makes sense to go on believing what they say. And so they don't have a lot of reason to question what their leaders say until someone like us comes along and says, here are some reasons you need to rethink what you've been told.
So what are the objective reasons to believe that Jesus rose from the dead? You weren't there.
Yeah, well, the things that became very interesting to me early on were one, everyone grants that Jesus died by crucifixion. On a sort of street level or something like this, you'll find people say maybe he survived crucifixion or something like that. But for anyone who knows how Roman crucifixion works, you don't survive crucifixion. There's only one example in history of someone who actually survived crucifixion, and he only survived part of the crucifixion because they took him down and gave him the best medical treatment. And so he didn't endure the full crucifixion, which consisted of the scourging. And many people died just from the beating itself because, you know, this wasn't just a whip and you got a few lashes. This would rip your skin off and expose your muscles. And the ancient sources talk about people's intestines spilling out of them just from the beating at the beginning, or their skin hanging like ribbons off their backs and their veins and arteries being exposed. And so this was a brutal process. And past that, you had the crucifixion, which they could tell once you finally stop breathing that you're dead. And even beyond that, the Romans would practice a death blow just to be sure. They would either crush your skull or set you on fire or pierce your heart with a spear or take you down and let animals rip you apart. So they were brutally, brutally careful about crucifying people and making sure the person was dead. And so, no actual scholars are going to object to Jesus' death by crucifixion. And there wouldn't be much of a reason to object to Jesus' crucifixion, except for a bunch of people also thought they witnessed him afterwards. And what's interesting is, you know, we think of this as, I mean, lots of people grow up and they think this is just a bunch of nonsense. And I always believed when I thought I had an explanation for Christianity, I believed that the apostles really loved Jesus and his message, but their guy was crucified, and unlike other followers of, crucified messiahs, they decided to keep the message going. And in order to keep the message going, they made up a story about him rising from the dead, and it worked. They were successful. They helped spread his message around the world and helped Christianity spread by making this thing up. And so that's what I believed for years until I found out how the apostles died. And they went to their horrible, bloody deaths, proclaiming that Jesus had appeared to them, risen from the dead. And, just because someone is willing to die for something, that doesn't make it true, right? People die all the time for things that are false. When a terrorist flies his, you know, plane into a building or something like this to kill the unbelievers, that doesn't tell us that what he believes is true. But at the very least, it tells us that he really believes it. And the general principle here is that liars make poor martyrs. If you're lying about something, you're not willing to die for it. When the sword is at your throat, okay, I made that up. And this is what I was investigating when I was still an atheist. And when I found out how these guys died, I tried to think of one person in history, one person in all of history who died for something that he knew he made up. And I couldn't think of anyone who died for something that he knew was a lie. And so it didn't make sense to think that suddenly Jesus just had all of these followers who were willing to die horrible, bloody deaths for something that they made up. And so I had to conclude that they actually believed it. But they're in kind of a different category from other people nowadays who might die for something that they believe in. I think I'd be willing to die for what I believe in. But at the end of the day, I believed a message that I heard, and I believed some things I read, and I believe them with such confidence that maybe I'm willing to die. And they're, you know, jihadis who die for what they believe in. They're dying for something that they heard. They heard a message, they believed it, and then they were willing to die for it. The disciples of Jesus weren't dying for some message that they heard. They're dying for something they said they saw. And so the question was, what could have convinced these men? Not only that Jesus had appeared to them in some shady fashion, but what could have convinced them and given them such confidence that he had indisputably appeared to them, that even decades later, when they had every reason to doubt and they had years to start doubting anything they'd seen, still had complete confidence to such an extent that they're willing to endure torture and death for their claim. What could have given them that confidence? And I just couldn't think of anything apart from actually seeing him. You know, there are people who say maybe, you know, grief hallucinations or something like that. Well, by definition, a hallucination is something in the mind. If I'm hallucinating, the people around me aren't going to see the same thing. And so for an entire group to experience grief hallucinations would be extraordinarily odd. But apart from that, you've got other people who were in no position to experience grief hallucinations. Paul was not grieving over Jesus' death.
He was rejoicing.
Yeah, he saw the same thing. So I couldn't think of any way to explain basic known facts apart from we've actually got a miracle on our hands. And if we've got a man who has been resurrected, person who's been raised in that way, it seems that if anyone else in history has God's stamp of approval on him, it's Jesus. So if I'm going to listen to anyone tell me about God, I'm going to listen to that guy. And so, therefore, I let Jesus speak for God.
And that's a much more compelling argument than your imam told you so. There was one other thing, or at least one other thing I wanted to touch on, which is things get a little bit confusing to us, you know, kind of here in the United States, because we get told that the problem for, frankly, the problem for all of the tension between the Islamic world and the Western world is because Israel's occupying land that was once occupied by Palestinians and refuses to give it back. And that's really, you know, the core driver for, if not all of the problems, and, you know, 90% of the problem or 80% of the problem. And I just wanted to make use of your expertise about both the Quran and the life of Muhammad and the teaching of Islam to maybe shed light on the fact that that isn't the whole story, but there might be some enmity or animosity that long predates the Jewish presence in, doesn't literally predate the Jewish presence in Palestine, because that predates Muhammad, but anyway, predates the current geopolitical situation.
It's interesting that you used the word enmity, and this wasn't planned, of course, but let me read a Quran verse for you, which describes the status of the Jews according to Islam. So this is chapter 5, verse 82 of the Quran. And Allah says, strongest among men in enmity to the believers will you find the Jews and the pagans. So Allah says the strongest in enmity, and other translations say hostility towards the believers, i.e. Muslims, are the pagans and the Jews. So according to the Quran itself, Jews are with pagans among the most hostile people against Muslims. And you find other passages of the Quran. Chapter 98, verse 6 says that Christians and Jews are the worst of creatures. And so you find these things in the Quran. And if you're a Muslim who really takes these things to heart, and just to be clear, lots of Muslims don't. There are lots of Muslims who've never read these passages. There are lots of Muslims who don't have terribly ill feelings towards other people and so on. But at the end of the day, you do have in the Muslim sources a lot of complaints about other groups. And the Jews are at the top. For a while, it was pagans, but the Jews came to be more and more emphasized in the Muslim groups, in the Muslim sources, to the point where Muhammad said that the end will not come. The resurrection going to paradise will not come until Muslims fight the Jews to such an extent that the Jews are running, hiding behind rocks and trees, and the rocks and trees are actually going to miraculously cry out, "There's a Jew hiding behind me, come and kill him." And so this is from the beginning of Islam all the way to the end times, according to Islam, that Jews are going to be among the most hostile enemies of Muslims. And then all of a sudden you get the nation of Israel restored. And that is upsetting to Muslims, but it's because it's in the context of here's a group of people that we hate more than any other group, and we just can't beat them, and they're right there. And it's like you took an entire group of Jews and put them right in the middle of Muslim lands, and they can't do anything about it. So the hostility is already there. The hostility towards Jews is already there. This just sort of gives them a target to point to and say, this is why we're really angry.
Let me throw a little gasoline on the fire, which is my understanding is it's in some sense it's even worse than that, because the proof of the correctness of Islam is military victory over the enemies of Islam.
Yeah.
And that's in some sense, it's the only miracle that Muhammad performed was successfully conquering other people. And that's why they shout Allahu Akbar, right? When they engage in jihad, because it's exactly this victory of the physical force which establishes the truth of the religion. So if they're unable to establish victory over the most hated enemies of Islam, the Jews, then it kind of undermines their entire theological framework.
Oh, it absolutely does. And after the Muslim caliphate fell, after World War I, you saw a lot of places in the Middle East start adopting more Western dress and so on, because they viewed it as a victory of another culture. They beat us. Their culture beat us. They have a more powerful culture. If you look at pictures of Iran from the 50s, you think you were looking at women in New York.
Well,
they're wearing Western dress and so on. So it does play a role. But there are basically two interpretations. Because if you read the Muslim sources, the perspective you get from the Muslim sources is Islam is just going to keep advancing and keep advancing and keep advancing until it has authority over the entire world. Muhammad said he'd been shown a vision that Allah showed in the entire world, and Islam had authority over everything. So that's what everything is marching towards. So when you have other people, other nations being more powerful than Islam and Muslims being powerless to stop these things, you basically have two possible interpretations. One, that they're victorious because Islam is just wrong, or Islam is not what it claimed to be. Or two, that we're being punished by Allah or tested by Allah. So we're either being punished for some rebellion, in which case we need to stamp out heresy, in which case Allah will then bless us, or Allah is temporarily testing our faithfulness to see if we will push on and push the Jews out. And of course, just for everyone who thinks that Israel is the problem, guess what? If Israel ever were handed over to Muslims, the attention would turn immediately to Spain, because Muslims also controlled Spain and lost that control. And so one interpretation is, well, Islam is just wrong. It's not true that we're going to advance and take over the world. But the other interpretation is that we're being tested or punished for something, in which case we need to show how faithful we are. And this is part of the push behind movements like the Salafi movement and so on, or, you know, what happened in Iran, that crackdown of control, where everyone has to be compelled to, you know, adopt full Islamic Sharia and obedience. It's we have to purify our community, and then Allah will bless us to beat the Jews and the Christians and take over the world. And so this is actually being used by Muslim leaders to crack down on their own people.
Well, that's really interesting. I don't. It sounds like damning with faint praise. It's totally new to me, but the light bulbs are going off in my head, you know. And so it sounds like the implication of what you're saying is the resurgence of fundamentalist Islam or the desire to repurify these Islamic cultures that is epitomized by ISIS and, you know, crackdowns. As you say, Iran didn't used to be oppressive like it is and so forth, is in fact a response to the Western world's apparent dominance over Islam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you look at the Muslim sources, that is not the way things should be, according to the Muslim sources. Muslims should be the most powerful. Muslims should be dominating. When other nations are dominating, there's something wrong, and it's either there's something wrong with Islam or there's something wrong with Muslims. And if it's just something wrong with Muslims, then
we're
going to
enforce Sharia brutally over the entire Muslim population and regain Allah's favor and conquer the West as a result.
Yeah.
Pretty scary stuff. Mm-hmm. I think you mentioned last night that your wife referred to you as having a charism of discouragement.
Yeah.
But wow, that's sobering. Another thing, I don't know if this resonates with you or not, but when you said that about the day of resurrection won't happen until all the Jews are killed and the stone says, oh, Muslim, there's a Jew behind me, come and kill him and so forth. I speaking from the context of Catholic doctrine, I don't know how widespread this is in non-Catholic Christianity, but it's actually Catholic dogma that the resurrection, the second coming, can't happen until all the Jews are converted.
Hmm.
And that's based largely on a couple of scripture passages. It's based on Romans 11, where St. Paul says, lest you be wise in your own conceits, brethren, I want you to understand this mystery. A hardening has come upon part of the Jews until the full number of the Gentiles come in, and so all Israel will be saved. And also Jesus, when he wept over Jerusalem and said, how often I would have oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often I would have gathered you as a mother hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you would not have me. I tell you truly, you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, which is understood to be a reference to the Jews accepting Jesus as the Messiah. So here we have in Islam that the day of resurrection won't happen until the Jews are killed. We have in Christianity, or at least in Catholicism, that the day of resurrection, the second coming, won't happen until the Jews all convert. We have the Great Commission in Christianity, which is go and make disciples of all nations. Mm-hmm. We have the Great Commission in Islam, which is essentially go in and force the subdual, right, of all peoples to, you know, Sharia law. Would it be too much of a stretch to say there's something that looks very much like a caricature of Christianity and Islam?
Muhammad was clearly influenced by both Judaism and Christianity. Even before he identified himself as a prophet at the age of 40, he's apparently a Meccan caravan trader, so he'd go on the caravan routes and so on, but he knew many Jews, and he encountered Christians during his travels. And we find lots of stories that are drawn from Jewish and Christian sources in the Quran, some of them from, Orthodox sources, some of them from heretical sources. But lots of the sources that Jews and Christians are used, and especially Jews and Christians of the time, we find the same stories in the Quran. So Muhammad was clearly influenced by Jews and Christians, but he didn't always understand what he was saying. Just like the Quran calls Jesus the Messiah. What does that mean in Islam? It doesn't mean, they have no concept of what it means, why it identifies him as the Messiah. According to the Quran, the Trinity is made up of Allah, Jesus, and Mary. No Christian group maintains a Trinity made up of Allah, Jesus, and Mary. I can understand an Arab caravan trader getting that wrong if he hears Christians talking about the Trinity, and he hears them referring to the Father and the Son and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and Trinity. Oh, okay. Well, maybe this is like a little holy family. Well, that's wrong. And so, you know, Muhammad just keeps hearing things and they end up in the Quran and doesn't seem to understand what they mean. Like the Quran calls Jesus the word of Allah, right? That's we know what being the word of God means according to Christian scriptures. What does it mean according to the Quran? The Quran just gives no indication of what this could mean. The Quran refers to the book given to Jesus as the Injil. The Arabic word Injil is an Arabic transliteration of the Greek word euangelion. Euangelion is a Greek word that means good news and referred to a specific type of good news. But according to Islam, Jesus only went to his fellow Jews and was not sent to the wider world. Well, if Jesus was only sent to his fellow Jews, why is his book in Greek, right? And so there are all these things where Muhammad is just obviously hears something among the Christians or hears something among the Jews, incorporates it into his sources without having any clue of what these things really mean.
I don't know if this is true or not. I have a vague memory that the Quran confuses Miriam, the sister of Moses, with Mary, the mother of Jesus.
Yeah. So in the Quran, they're the same person. Mary.
So Jesus is Moses's nephew.
Yeah, and Muhammad was eventually challenged on this, and so was Aisha and so on. And because in Arabic, it's the same word.
Miriam.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so the same name.
It's the same
Hebrew
name.
Yeah, of course.
And so Muhammad just didn't know that these were two different people spread with a pretty wide time gap in between them. And so these are the kinds of things, but... yeah, so Muhammad is clearly influenced, and that's why you can see parallels between certain Christian teachings or Christian ideas, even if they're not Orthodox Christian teachings, if they existed in 7th century Arabia among Jews or among Christians, you see that influence in the Quran.
Do you use these apparent, I don't know what to say, call them garbled accounts from Judaism and Christianity that appear in the Quran? Is that part of your apologetics to Muslims to show that, you know, there's some confusion here?
Yeah, I mean, there. If I only had a limited amount of time, I would probably use something else. But if things are going on long enough, then you certainly want to share that with Muslims, because I mean there are stories and we know where the stories come from, and they're just false. Jesus speaking at birth, we know where that story comes from, and it doesn't come from anywhere near the first century, and not just with Jewish or Christian stories. Alexander the Great traveling so far west, he finds the place where the sun sets, and we know where these stories come from. We have them. We have these stories in earlier sources and sources that are earlier than the Quran. We know they're not true. We can trace their origin. We know that Alexander the Great did not actually find the place where the sun sets. We know that. And yet in the Quran, that's what he did. In the Quran, he's also a Muslim. We know Alexander the Great was as pagan as someone can possibly be up until his death. And yet in the Quran, he's a devout Muslim. So, you know, if this were the word of Allah, it would seriously call into question Allah's knowledge, because he's just getting so many different things completely wrong. But if, you know, if this ultimately comes from Muhammad or his contemporaries, it makes sense for them to be taking these stories.
Now, one of my suppositions, I'm not an Islam scholar, as I would argue you are. One of my suppositions was at various points in his life, Muhammad was trying to recruit people from among the pagans and from among the Jews and from among the Christians. And so he kind of, this is my mental picture, is he would turn to a group and say, you Jews, you almost have it right, but you distorted the scriptures, and this is what they really say, and so kind of sell Islam as a true version of Judaism. Similarly, sell Islam as a true version of Christianity to Christians, sell Islam as the true version of paganism to pagans, and that's one of the reasons why you get this kind of, if I can say so, amateurish incorporation of various aspects of the different religions into Islam. Is that fair?
Well, there is a progression. When Muhammad starts off, he's in he's in pagan Mecca among the polytheists, and he's a monotheist. So if you were a Christian or a Jew during that time, and you see a monotheist talking about the biblical prophets among pagans, you think, wow, this is really cool. This is cool that this guy is taking a stand. And that is what the early, what some early Christians and Jews thought. It's cool that there is a guy in Mecca proclaiming monotheism and proclaiming our prophets. And during this time, the attitude was kind of, it's me, Muhammad, and my followers, along with the Jews and the Christians, and we're united against the pagans, the polytheists. And so you pagans and polytheists, you're all in trouble. Us Muslims and Jews and Christians, we're good to go. We're good to go. We're good to go. We're all on the same side. Later, when he moves to Medina, there were three Jewish tribes there, and they rejected him. They made fun of him. And so then the revelations change, and it's me and the Christians versus the pagans and the Jews. And the verse I quoted earlier, where he says that the greatest in enmity towards the believers are the pagans and the Jews. Right after that, it says, but closest in love to the believers are those who say we are Christians. So right there, you have it. You have it's Jews and Christian. I mean, it's Jews and pagans on one side and Christians and Muslims on the other side. And then, of course, the Christians also rejected him. And then you get to chapter 9 of the Quran, fight those who do not believe in Allah. And it specifically refers to Jews and Christians as the people who have to be targeted. And so by that point, it's only Muslims. And so, I mean, I think Muhammad really believed that he was a prophet and just didn't deal well with rejection. I think when he was in Mecca, he really believed that the Jews and Christians were going to accept him, that, hey, I'm preaching your stuff. I'm preaching what you preach. I'm preaching monotheism and that we all need to submit to God. Of course, you guys are going to side with me. And then the Jews reject him first. And then, you guys are in trouble with Allah because I'm obviously a prophet and you're rejecting me. So you guys have been led astray. You guys are astray. So it's me and the Christians now. But then the Christians reject him. Wait a minute. Everyone's wrong here. Everyone's wrong except for those people who are following me. And so you all have to be subjugated so you don't lead people astray.
Well, that leads to what to me is the $64,000 question, which is, essentially, what is the source of the Quran? I mean, in other words, I think we can conclude it wasn't really the angel Gabriel mm-hmm. dictating it, but what's your understanding? Did Muhammad really come up with the Quran? Did it come out of him? Was it some other form of revelation? In this schema, where does the Quran come from?
There are scholars who claim that the Quran actually goes back to earlier works in other languages like Syriac and so on, that you can find traces of earlier revelation that Muhammad is, I mean, not revelation, but earlier sources that Muhammad. The idea is it's an oral culture. So the idea is he would be traveling and people did public readings, just like, I mean, most Christians couldn't read for early on. And so you'd have the public readings and so on. But he's even accused in the Quran. He's constantly accused of stealing his revelations from other people. And so you have, even during his time, and even according to the Quran, over and over again, he's being accused of getting information from other people and passing it off as revelation. And it's interesting, one of the times he's accused in the Quran, it says, and they say that he's getting his stories from this other person. And it says, but this other person is a foreigner and the Quran is written in Arabic. So notice the assumption there that Muhammad couldn't be getting information from this other person and putting it into Arabic because you can't translate it. In other words, this would be like me, you know, writing Crime and Punishment in English, and you say, David, you just copied Crime and Punishment. I say, no, that was in Russian. This is in English. Right? That's Allah's response. Muhammad couldn't be copying this information he was getting from this guy because that guy isn't speaking in Arabic, but the Quran is in Arabic. So we know this is a challenge even back then. So whether this goes all the way back to, you know, centuries older Syriac works or something like this, I don't know. But we find so much of the Quran that is all around Muhammad during that time.
I'm gonna bounce back what you started out saying in the show, but because what made me stop was when you said you thought that Muhammad thought he really was a prophet. Mm-hmm. So how could he have really thought he was a prophet while he's plagiarizing, knowingly plagiarizing other stuff?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think he hears these stories, and these stories are in his head, and he's hearing stories from Jews and from Christians. And I believe it's actually coming out of him sort of poetically, like he's just, they're forming poems and he believes that they're revelation. And just okay. to be clear,
so that's a state of insanity. Yeah,
just to be clear, I'm not saying this is the way it is, right? I'm saying yeah. we have a certain amount of data. What's the best interpretation of the yeah. data? When I see that Muhammad went, you know, fought battle after battle after battle, putting himself in danger in these battles. It's the same criterion I apply to like the Apostle Paul. If you're willing to be killed for what you're saying, I think you believe it. So I think Muhammad did really believe, that he was some sort of prophet. But at the same time, we see so many of his revelations that either have no purpose other than satisfying his personal desires. Like when the Quran says that Muslims can only have up to 4 wives and Muhammad gets 9 because Allah gives him a special revelation saying you get more. Well, that sounds like something that just some guy would want. It doesn't seem like there's any greater purpose to it. And so why is this in the Quran? But it looks like his desires are influencing his revelations. They're obviously the sources of the stories of the people around him are influencing his revelations. And, you know, I mean, if I had to pick, I can't be confident because I think it would be entirely reasonable to say that he's making this up and he just happened to be a guy who was willing to die to go out and fight these battles. And not because he was really convinced that it was true, but because, he just really was conquering and was just using his religion to unite people. I think you could argue that.
But that's assuming that he really did put his life on the line in those battles.
Well, that's true. I mean, Muslim sources say he was injured and so on. So anyway, I think, you know, a person could maintain that position. If I had to pick I'm a little more confident in the claim that he really believed that he was a prophet. Just going through the Muslim sources and yeah. seeing him, you know, laying down all these revelations, it sounds like someone who I think had some mental problems. Yeah. And
what about my pet theory, which is he did think he was a prophet and he was receiving diabolical revelation?
Yeah, I actually lay that when I debate with on a stage with Muslims about whether Muhammad was a prophet. I basically say there are three main possibilities for, you know, Christians, Muslims who believe in God and Satan and demons and so on. One, that he's getting the revelations from his own mind. So he's either crazy or he's deliberately inventing revelations, but there's no source other than his mind and, you know, picking and choosing and things like that. Two, since Christians and Muslims agree that there are darker forces at work in the world, that he could actually be getting revelations, but they're demonic in origin. And interestingly, that was Muhammad's first interpretation of his revelations. When he started getting revelations, he came out of there and said that a demon had attacked him. It was actually his wife and her cousin who said, no, God would never allow that to happen to you. You must be a prophet. So his interpretation was, I just encountered a demon. And it was people who weren't there who convinced him, no, you actually encountered an angel. So we have to, especially when you look at all the other sources, I mean, when we read the Muslim sources about Muhammad receiving his revelations, it sounds like something out of an exorcist movie. His face would turn red. He would start sweating profusely, even if it was cold out. His mouth would start trembling. The veins in his neck would stand out. And so this is like the description of him getting his revelation. So there's plenty of room there to say, that there's something darker at work. And, of course, the third possibility is he's actually getting revelations from God, and we have to wonder why we should believe that he's getting revelations from God. But, you know, until Muslims come up with some really good reason to believe that it was getting revelations from God, we're down to the other two possibilities. And I think we have good reasons to believe both of those things, to believe, that he was getting revelations from his own mind and his surroundings, and that there may have been some demonic influence, because Islam just looks too perfectly anti-Christian to just be a coincidence, right? I mean, when it's, I agree with you that Jesus was born of a virgin. I agree with you that Jesus is the Messiah. I agree with you that Jesus lived the most miraculous life in history. The only things we disagree with, Jesus didn't die on the cross for sins. He didn't rise from the dead, and he's not Lord. which those three things just happened to be the core of the Christian gospel that was preached by the apostles wherever they went in the book of Acts. And so to say, Christians, I agree with you on pretty much everything, things that no one else is ever going to agree with you on, like the virgin birth. I agree with you on all those things, except the three core elements of the Christian gospel. That's what I have to deny. And the Christian response should be, wow, we've been looking for you.
There's another part of the Christian gospel, which is really at the core, which is the opposite of Islam, which is God is love versus God is a cruel taskmaster. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons I'm so suspicious about the source of the revelation to Muhammad is precisely because Satan doesn't care about man's love. Mm-hmm. He doesn't care about man's free will at all. The difference between the God of Christianity and the God of Islam in personality and in what they care about looks a lot like the difference between the God of Christianity and the enemy of the God of Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you look at what Jesus said in Matthew 5, when he says, if you only love those who love you, what are you doing more than tax collectors and sinners? So Jesus condemns the kind of love that says, you love me first and then I'll love you. And he says that the reason we shouldn't love people like that is so that we can be like our Father in heaven, who sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous and so on. So Jesus is saying, don't just be people who love those who love you. Imitate God. And so God is the one who loves us all. And in Christianity, we love God because he first loved us. You go to the Quran, chapter 3, verse 32, Allah does not love the unbelievers. So you will only be loved by Allah if you turn to him and submit to him and obey him first, and then he might love you. But the Quran is filled with lists of people Allah doesn't love. Allah doesn't love the mischief makers. Allah doesn't love those who are proud and so on. It just keeps talking about all the people Allah doesn't love. And at the end of the day, Allah only loves you if you're a good, devout Muslim. And so you love Allah and then he loves you. And yes, and complete reverse from God loving us and therefore us responding in love.
So we are pretty much out of time, but I did want to give you an opportunity. If you had I think this entire show has been an exhortation to at least pray for the conversion of Muslims, to certainly have empathy and compassion on the situation that people are in who, through no fault of their own, are encompassed by this belief system. So you've already kind of, this whole show has been an exhortation to pray for that. But if there's anything else that you want to leave us with.
Yeah, there are 1.6 billion Muslims in the world. They're over a fifth of the world's population. Yet there's very little emphasis on reaching them. And they are just wide open for the gospel. For the first time in history, we have an opportunity to show them that they've been misled and to show them the truth about Jesus. And I certainly don't want to stand before God saying, you blessed us with every opportunity that Christians could have ever dreamed of to reach Muslims with the gospel in every Muslim country in the world. But we were too worried about being called names or being called racist or something like that to take advantage of that opportunity. Don't want to stand before God like that. I want to be able to stand before God and say, thank you for that opportunity you gave us, and I'm glad we were able to use it.
I have nothing to add to that. I absolutely. Amen, brother. And I want to thank you so much for joining us and for joining our audience and on what I'm sure was very, very eye-opening but also inspirational look into Islam and the need to pray for the conversion of those who may be under its shadow. And thank you for coming on, and thank you for spending this time with us. And I want to thank our listeners for tuning in, and invite you to tune in again next week for Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism, on Radio Maria. This is Roy Shoman saying bye for now.